Next week marks the one-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, better known as the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Oil flowed into the Gulf for 3 months. The environmental impact of the spill continues. Today, we get an update from a couple of fronts. Joining us in studio is Christopher Reddy, senior scientist of marine chemistry and geochemistry at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He studies the aftermaths of oil spills. And Rob Moonier, vice president for marine operations and facilities at HUE, an incident response team lead, which heads up HUE's response efforts to the oil spill. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
In a couple minutes, we'll talk with a nature writer, David Gessner, who traveled to the Gulf to write about the impact the spill had on birds for the Natural Resources Defense Council. So it was April 20th, an explosion on the oil rig Deepwater Horizon killed 11 crewmen, ignited a fire that eventually led to the rig sinking into the sea, leaving that well gushing oil at the seafloor. And it's really hard to put your head around the amount of oil that was spilled. I can remember seeing that video, those first video where we saw the underwater, and it just seems so impossible. At what point, and Chris, I'll start with you, what point did you get involved, and what was your task, what were you asked to do?
I actually was probably working on the spill within a few hours because I was not as much concerned about the oil going out of the bottom of the seafloor, but actually the 800,000 gallons of diesel fuel, which would be spilling, which would be one of the largest spills of oil in the last 20 years. So I was much more concerned about the diesel fuel and was doing calculations and talking to a few government officials about that. Within a few days, it became apparent that there was another spill that was of significant larger damage. And I remember speaking to a federal scientist saying, this is going to be a very long oil spill and be prepared to be involved for a while.
Yeah. Rob, what about you? When did you get involved?
Well, we were approached initially by BP, as a matter of fact, to take a look at if what types of technologies we might have to help determine what the flow rates might be, and also to look, did we have any mechanism for looking inside the blowout preventer for the purpose of trying to determine just what the problem was as to why the blowout preventer wasn't performing as it was supposed to. Mm-hmm. So that was our first instance of getting involved, and that was within a few days after the event.
Yeah, so they called you in pretty much right away then. So tell us a little bit about what role the submersibles played, because, you know, you can't exactly put people down there.
Well, that actually took a bit of time for the submersible element of our arsenal, if you will, to be deployed, because it just takes time to get these types of things organized
there, yeah,
and down to the Gulf of Mexico. But we ended up during the course of last year, beginning in June on the trip that Chris was on and was one of the co-leaders on, we deployed all of our submersibles at different times during the course of from June through actually the end of the year. So the Sentry, which is an autonomous vehicle, was used, and I'm sure Chris can elaborate on this, mm-hmm, to deploy some of our key sensors that allowed us to develop a way to look at the plume. We also deployed one of our remote-operated vehicles, which is a tethered vehicle but still unmanned, to look at benthic communities and what the impacts were, and that was during the fall. And then we had the submersible Alvin, mm-hmm, and it made two different cruises to the Gulf to follow up on some of the determinations that were made using our ROV.
Chris, I would imagine that the information that those submersibles can gather is really key to your work.
Yeah, certainly all three of them. I was most intimately involved with Sentry on the last 2 weeks of June with my colleagues, Rich Camilli and Dana Yerger. And the data that we collected helped identify that a subsurface plume at about 3,000 feet existed and was continuing to occur. I will add to you that vehicle alone has yielded so much data that it would keep me busy for a year studying more about this spill. So there is no shortage of questions that can be addressed that were in part collected from the collection of data from just a couple releases of this vehicle and recoveries of it.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned you study the aftermath of oil spills, and it gets tricky because there are all kinds of variables involved, so it complicates the situation. So comparing one spill to another is not really something you want to do.
No, and as a general rule, oil spill scientists hate the Exxon Valdez because everybody uses it as a reference point. And in reality, the Exxon Valdez is probably in number 55 in the number of oil spills in terms of the volume of oil that's been spilled. So it's a relatively small spill. It gained a lot of attention because CNN was just looking for footage. And of course, it also happened in U.S. Territory. But nevertheless, we keep making parallels to that spill. And in reality, one of the basic tenets of oil spills is that all oil spills are different. It's not necessarily means that we can't learn from past ones. But to make any type of, you know, predictions based on a last spill is quite wrong, actually.
Yeah, and in fact, looking at the environmental impact in testimony you gave to legislators in Washington, you gave an example of two diesel fuel spills off New England. Both had devastating short-term impacts, but really differed in long-term impact.
Yeah, sure. I worked on the 1996 North Cape oil spill, which was an incredibly devastating spill, killed 21 million lobsters within 12 hours. But within a few months, you'd be hard-pressed to find any of that diesel fuel in Narragansett, Rhode Island. I also work on an oil spill that occurred in 1969 in West Falmouth, which is a famed oil spill. And in fact, I think the most well-studied oil spill in the history of all oil spills in terms of timelines, started by on the shoulders of giants here at Huey. And there we still can find the remnants of oil there. It's not necessarily a lot of the oil, but it is a living laboratory that we take advantage of to understand how nature responds to an uninvited guest like oil.
We're talking about the BP oil spill, and we're going to talk about its impacts and, you know, the status in just a couple seconds. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you have a question or a comment. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Rob, as I mentioned, you're the incident response team lead here for Huey. Are you coordinating not only Huey, but with other organizations, with the projects that Huey's involved with?
Yes, somewhat. Response team coordinator at Huey has got a unique meaning in that Huey's really a group of fairly independent scientists that do their work and do it, you know, on a world-class basis. My job really was to be sure that we kind of kept together our message and that I acted as a cheerleader to some extent. Mm-hmm. And also tried to be sure that we were incorporating all the different groups so that when opportunities or questions arose, we were able to put a solution together. I think one of the things we thought at the outset was that Huey is a world leader in this ability to respond to an oil spill in terms of our tools, in terms of our expertise, in terms of our laboratory capability. And people like Chris, we need to make them available so that we could respond to this national emergency. And so that was really kind of the focus behind, you know, centralizing to some extent the idea of our response.
Now, we've got a lot of different projects going on. So what programs are ongoing that you're involved with? Too many to mention.
There are just so many of them.
Really?
I mean, anywhere from, was one of the plumes that we identified toxic to anything that was living at 3,000 feet to a project that I'm working on right now about whether or not tar paddies that we keep finding on the beach are a problem and how much they make up of the oil that was lost. Let me remind you that Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has five departments. All five departments have scientists involved. So they span from biological effects to engineering to geologic changes. I can't even go where to start.
On.
I mean,
yeah.
It is a massive effort by Huey to investigate this project. And I want to make a key point here is that, you know, Woods Hole Oceanographic is a group of environmental scientists. We're not environmentalists. I don't really, frankly, care whether it was BP or MVP oil. Mm-hmm. We just care about looking at the science, how things change, what we can do, how might we make changes to engineering designs, how we may help deliver good product to policymakers. Mm-hmm. But we're not in the business of policies, and we're not a non-governmental governmental organization. We're scientists.
Right. And, of course, go ahead, Rob. You want to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to add on the question of what's happening and what's going on, just to kind of pile on with what Chris just said. We just finished a cruise in the Gulf using our vessel, the Oceanus, where we towed a video plankton recorder, which is a unique device. It essentially is a underwater video microscope, collected 8 million images over 3,000 miles of transit between Texas and Alabama. So this was a huge data set that was just collected that will help to, you know, build on the work that's been done in the Gulf. And that crew's just finished, wrapped up last week. And on April 20th, we're deploying on the NOAA ship MacArthur with a team of scientists that are going to be looking at benthic communities. And we're going to be using a towed device that also takes cameras, as well as the Sentry, the same vehicle that Chris used last year in June, to map the plume. And this is going to be used to map the seafloor and then to photograph the seafloor so that we can study the benthic communities. This work was started in some isolated locations using the Alvin and the ROV Jason last year. And so this is building on that work.
Right. Let me just add one point. Yep. You know, many of the scientists who are working at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution never were involved in oil spills in the past. In fact, this video plankton recorder that was developed by Cabell Davis, you know, he studies zooplankton and other little small critters. The fact that he was so nimble enough to change and use that technology to look at oil droplets is, you know, a testimony that basic science needs to be and continue to be fostered, and that you can be nimble and to attack problems when they come up in a applied manner.
You just got back. You were there last week.
Yep.
And so what are you finding? You're searching the beaches, and you said you were looking at tarballs, and I know you brought a piece of something in with you here.
Yeah. So I walked Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida looking, and I was on the Chanlia Islands, which is about 50 miles off the coast of the Gulf, looking for small patties of oil. I'm particularly interested in about how the oil has changed with time. Oil has many, many different compounds, and they all change in what we call weather differently. And so I'm curious about what the oil looks like now, where you look and you find in the environment, to what came out of that gusher when you saw on CNN. What I brought in the lab was actually pieces of the Deepwater Horizon wreck itself that I picked up off the beach in one location. Yeah. So I just was showing it actually to Rob because I just got home and he hadn't seen
and
it
I
yet.
And I just happened to look over.
Yeah, yeah. So we were talking shop.
Yeah. Before the... So Chris, as you're looking at the way the oil weathers,
yes.
What does that tell you anything as far as what the impact on the environment is going to be going further from here?
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, if you have a snapshot or an idea as to what's still there, let's just say that you look at a tar paddy right now or a paddy of oil and you see what its composition is, you can get an idea as to whether or not it's biologically active and get an idea as to whether or not it's essentially immune or pretty close to immune or whether or not it's of higher concern. So that is, from a practical perspective, that is what we're trying to do. But I'm also curious about, you know, how nature beat on this oil and changed its composition with time.
Right. Are you also looking at the marine life and the impact that the spill has had?
Not necessarily. But, this is a key point that you just brought up. I mean, as much as I think I'm a great scientist and I have a huge ego, there's just absolutely no way that I could there's absolutely no way that I could attack all these pressing problems. And it's, you know, we're all tuned into the CSI effect of TV where one person can solve all problems. Yeah. But in reality, most of them have to be put together by a team scientists who can work collectively to solve such problems.
And we should say it's not just a Hui team down there. These are scientists from all over the place, right?
No. Yeah. My closest collaborator is at the University of California at Santa Barbara, who I speak to almost every day.
Wow. Well, also walking the beaches is David Gessner. He's a nature writer, blogger, and an associate professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And he traveled to the Gulf last summer to write about the spill and bird migration for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's joining us on the phone. Morning, David.
Morning, Mindy.
Now, you're the first to say you're not a scientist, but writing...
No, I'm not a scientist.
You're writing about your observations. And this article turned into a blog, and those posted into a book, The Tarball Chronicles, which will be out later this year. So you came at this from a different perspective than many of the news reports. As you say, it's a strange mix of part nature writing, part journalism, part adventure. What were you looking for? What was your task?
Well, I wasn't looking for anything. I really had no plan going into it. In fact, I'd put blinders on about the spill itself. I'd had enough environmental depression. I'd been traveling earlier in the year. And a friend convinced me. He said, "You've been walking the coast, studying the coast since you lived on the Cape. You've continued to do that. You've got to get down there." And I thought, he's right. And I headed down there. And really, what I tried to collect was on-the-ground impressions, like a you-are-there kind of feeling. And for me, you know, I think I said to you the other day that this time I didn't want to be taken on the knee of the national media and told the national story. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see it for myself. And it didn't take much time. I landed in Pensacola, saw my first kind of ghostly prison crew of workers, 50 to 100 of them sweeping the sands through the mist. Within a couple hours, I saw a guy from Texas fighting with a guy from Pensacola over a giant tarball. The Texas guy wanted to claim it and bring it home as a tourist prize. I kept seeing beautiful things mixed with strange things. I watched Rosie at Spoonbill by Halliburton Road. As you know, I write about ospreys and think about ospreys a lot, and I watched kind of Mission Control, where the backward beeping of trucks mixed with the "kew, kew, kew" of the osprey cries. So what I was really trying to do is give my readers a sense of what the story was like there versus what they were seeing on TV.
Right. On the national, and that image of the oil-soaked birds is, and other marine life, of course, it's just heart-wrenching. You were lucky enough, to befriend the Cousteau film team, so you got some access to some bird rehabilitation that you might not have been involved with otherwise.
Yeah, as I say, I had no plan, but I kind of lucked out. I went down to Burris in southern Louisiana, and the only other people, nobody was staying there because of the spill, the only other people staying there were the Cousteau film team. And they took me up on the helicopter the next morning and out on the waters quite a lot, and took me in to see the oiled pelicans. And I had been kind of a cynic at that point. In fact, I was calling whatever the latest accepted story was the oiled pelican. For instance, people thought that the story had been overreported at first, and by fall they were saying it was underreported. So I was kind of crusty about the oiled pelicans, until I actually saw one in their plywood cage. And I really had a moment of deep empathy. This bird had kind of a black wing, more like an eagle or an osprey, and it was reaching out to touch its mate to not be alone. It had just been brought in that afternoon. And this sense of displacement really overwhelmed me. And I really felt for the first time, you know, I've written about nature on the Cape, and Bob Finch has an anthology called A Place Apart. Mm-hmm. I've always thought of nature as a place apart, and never before had I felt nature so connected to our world and to our resources and to our lives. And I felt, very much when I left the Gulf, I felt like it was one of the most important things I've ever done going down there.
You have a lot to say about the media, and moving on to the next story.
Yeah, I felt like it was over. You know, I remember hearing Diane Sawyer asked somebody, "Are you still seeing tarballs?" And when they said they were, she kind of rolled her eyes in a conspiracy theory sort of way. And I felt when I went back in October, I haven't, unlike the scientists, I haven't been back there recently. I'm waiting till the school term ends and heading back down there. But when I went back in October, I talked to one of my main contacts, Ryan Lambert, who's the owner of the Cajun Fishing Lodge. And he was telling me about having gone out the week before and still seeing the tars and still seeing, finding a dead bird. And he came back and took me out back and showed me a huge pile of shrimp with little black gills. And he, who had been, patrolling those waters for 30 years, was not entirely convinced that the story was over.
Yeah.
But I do want to say, here's where I am allied with the scientists, that, I come in with no certainty. I come in and I am not interested in saying, this is what happened, this is what will happen. I think humility is really the appropriate reaction to something like this, and certainty and overconfidence it gets you into a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Any comments before we let David go?
I certainly would agree with David's latter comments. Yeah. And in fact, I would say that both science and the media would get a mixed grade in terms of their ability to communicate effectively. I think the media in particular treated this spill like the O.J. Simpson trial, where it was 1 week, there was a different thing, whether it was dispersants or oiled birds or blowout preventers or top hat. And unfortunately, somehow or another, what the media decided was newsworthy wasn't always the most scientifically important. And believe it or not, that actually played a key role in the politics of the spill.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah,
and you really got a different story down there in terms of what, you were talking to people about erosion and the flow of the Mississippi, and you were just hearing different things than you were hearing when you turned on the TV.
Right. Rob, you want to make comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that from a science perspective and certainly from our perspective, this story has still got
a long way to go. Yeah,
There'll be a lot of work to be done for a long period of time.
Yeah. And David, for folks who want to check out your blog or your writing, where should we send them?
It's called Bill and Dave's Cocktail Hour.
Bill and Dave Cocktail Hour, okay.
And Ben Rohrbeck, who's a great writer in Maine, and I bat around a lot of things, environmental issues, but a lot of other issues.
Okay, and you can hear an audio essay, Oiled Pelican, by David Gessner at our website, capeandislands.org, and click on The Point. David, thanks for being with us this morning. Appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
All right, so let's talk about, you mentioned dispersants, and we've heard about that. Concerns about potential negative impacts of the dispersants that were used? Are there some?
Well, I think trying to identify any effect at this point is really difficult. You have a damaged Gulf already from a lot of other human-induced activities. So trying to find a blip on a moving baseline is difficult. The usage of dispersants is this. The people who make those decisions to use dispersants on the surface of the ocean write papers about the usage of dispersants year in, year out. They respond to the 200 oil spills that happen annually. So they are the people you want making. This is not way to go brownie. These are the people you want in your corner making these decisions. I have no problem with them using this, making those decisions in the surface. They were tasked with the opportunity to inject dispersants at the where the well was leaking out oil, and they decided to do that. These people who decided to do it were the people I would want to make that decision. Right now, the data does not exist and may never exist as whether that was a good or a bad idea. But we must be prudent. We must be vigilant. We must continue to look at the thousands of data that are in the pipeline and be able to hopefully diagnose whether or not dispersants were unsuccessful or successful in the subsurface. I'm confident that they were successful in the surface.
Yeah, I would just add, I was at a meeting about 3 or 4 weeks ago that involved a lot of oil company folks, and the discussion came around to dispersants and what the utility was. And I think they recognized that as a key open question about the utility and the impacts. And it's going to be a focus of research funds that they're planning on putting out that would try to answer that question so that in a future spill, you know.
Right, so we'll have more information.
But keep in mind, the National Research Council, that's run by the National Academy of Sciences, had a book that came out in 2005 called Dispersants and the Usage of Sea. This is not a field that has not been well studied. Right. It just has not been studied for the usage at 5,000 meters.
Right.
I mean, 5,000 feet, pardon me.
Right.
So let's just keep that in mind.
Right.
I mean, there is a large database.
All right, tell us the status of the oil now. As we said, this is ongoing. We're still seeing impacts. You're still picking up tarballs on the beaches, and you say it's changing. So
let's be careful about what impacts mean. I mean, we may be finding impacts that may have occurred within days of the spill. I mean, remember, the Gulf is huge, you know, and you can't put the Gulf in an MRI.
Right.
So you know, we have a time problem. You know, we may be seeing some effects that may have occurred within a week after the spill occurred. Doesn't mean that they're still occurring today. And so trying to disentangle when an effect occurred is a challenge within itself. Finding oil on the beach is likely an effect. But, you know, we must be cautious at this part.
And so this is studies that are ongoing then, because I think David mentioned the shrimp. I looked at that photo, the shrimp with the black gills. And so there's all kinds of things that may or may not be related to the oil. And as you're saying, how it weathers and what it's doing and breaking down into little.
Let me just give you one example. And after the Exxon Valdez, and again, I don't like to use Exxon Valdez, but it did get a lot of science addressed to it. You know, that occurred in 1989. And in 1994, 5 years later, a very good group of scientists were able to kind of close the books on where all the oil went. That was 5 years later from an 11 million gallon spill in a smaller area. So think about the challenges that we face in trying to essentially balance the books and understand this spill. This is a very long-term project that we must be vigilant, that we must continue to use good science to study it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it sort of makes the questions that you have to try to answer looking forward is, what do you need to know before a spill happens?
Mm-hmm.
What do you need to, how do you want to respond to a spill in the very near term? And then what are the long-term responses? And I think those types of questions are the ones we hope to have answers to, so that a future spill would have, instead of a B response like Chris referred to, we would do a better job.
Right. Let me ask you just said, balancing the books and where all the oil went. Where are we in that analysis in the Gulf now?
So what's happened right now is the federal government put together something called the oil budget calculator, which you can find on the web, which is based on using textbook equations and stuff to get a idea as to where oil went and was transported. Those are fine roadmaps to understand that. But you have to remember that there are tens of thousands of samples that were collected. Every sample has hundreds of compounds analyzed in. So you can start to build a huge database. And as much as that sounds daunting, it's also very powerful. So mm-hmm. I suspect that we will not be able to get an accurate balance of the oil spill for a while. And more importantly, some compounds that make up the oil are not that important. So in reality, we may want to start thinking about the important chemicals, that the ones that are most biologically active, and thinking about where all they went as mm-hmm. opposed to where the bulk of the oil went. And that's a subtlety that we must embrace.
Yeah, Rob, we mentioned earlier about the submersibles and how much data they were able to collect. You work with these things all the time. Were you surprised? Were there surprises that these submersibles came across that maybe was unexpected?
I think it was more of a validation of the utility of using them than a surprise. Mm-hmm. And the poster child of that is the use of the Sentry to map the plume. If you recall, prior to that cruise, which was in late June of last year, there was a lot of speculation about what the plume was, what was the nature of the plume, what water depth, was it a dark, viscous substance, or just what was the nature of it? And the Sentry was able to go out, map this thing, show its dimensions, and give us a much better handle. So I think it was more validated the use than caused us to have surprises.
Yeah. You have to remember, we had used Sentry maybe 9 months beforehand to look at natural gas and oil seeping off the coast of California with almost the same team for good basic science to understand natural oil spills, which input 50% of all the oil in the coastal environment. And so in many respects, we just brought the band back together and went back out there 9 months later. So yeah. We were certainly prepared because of good basic science.
Yeah. A lot of work done and a lot of work still to go, I guess, is the final analysis, and lots of data to sift through, and hopefully we'll learn a lot from this. I want to thank both of you, Rob Munier, Vice President of Marine Operations and Facilities at HUI, and Christopher Reddy, a senior scientist at HUI, studies aftermaths of oil spills. Thank you both for coming in studio and chatting with us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to David Gessner, a travel writer, who you can find some of his work on our website, capeandislands.org. Click on The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Mindy Todd, production assistants from Dan Tridle and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.